It's a happy occasion, a visit to our campus by Professor Helmut Kester, who is the John H. Morrison Professor of New Testament and the Wynn Professor of Ecclesiastical History at Harvard Divinity School. His subject tonight is New Testament Introduction, a Critical Appraisal of the Discipline. Dr. Kester.
Thank you very much, Everett. It's a pleasure to be here, I can assure you. And I'm delighted to have this opportunity. Let me begin with making some remarks about the history of the discipline that is normally called New Testament Introduction. By way of explanation, I should add that I got into this, writing this article, because I'm writing a New Testament introduction myself. And at the whole project and at various stages, I got into difficulties because I thought that the traditional ways in which one writes New Testament introductions had many great difficulties and began to think about it. And this article has grown out of my work, which is about two-thirds finished and which I hope it will be out sometime next year or not much thereafter. The most striking feature of the discipline introduction is the unusually high degree of self-assured security and complacency which characterizes its presuppositions and its aim. If for the moment we allow as the starting point of the discipline Richard Simon's Histoire Critique of 1663, there are reasons to dispute this. I will come back to this. This peculiar feature of complacency and self-assured security appears already at this early stage. Simon begins a long series of scholarly introductions written by generations of scholars who assume that their own possession of truth is perfect, even though the expression of this truth, as it is preserved in the poor manuscripts of the New Testament, is unfortunately not quite as perfect. In the same way, the leading biblical scholar of the period of rationalism, Johann Salomo Zembler, who lived from 1725 to 91, had no desire to interfere with the truth of the divine word when he subjected the writings of the Bible to critical questioning. But he continued the process by which critical investigation on the one hand and edification on the other were separated from each other. Zembler confronts the uncertainty of our own insights into the question of divine origin and inspiration of the Bible with the general and unchanging certainty and true quality of the Christian religion and of its true fundamental tenets. So, a rationalist of the 18th century. The parallelism of this Enlightenment position of Zembler with Simon's Roman Catholic position is striking. It was on the basis of this position that the scholarly enterprise of the critical investigation of biblical writings became possible. Historical judgments as well as philological insights have been the result. But the price paid is exorbitant. Henceforth, critical theological scholarship was delighted to assert that the progress of cultural developments in general and of religious insights in particular was no longer subject to the knowledge and insight which resulted from a critical and historical investigation of the biblical writings. Of course, the systematic theologian could continue to refer to the biblical foundation of his theological enterprise, but he would go about this business without the benefit of responsible scholarly methodology of critical scholarship. The biblical scholars themselves had proclaimed that nothing they did would disturb the everlasting truths of Christian religion. But in spite of such declarations of critical biblical scholars, that their work wasn't really meant as a threat and was ultimately irrelevant. More conservative theologians supposed, not without reason, that this was not quite the case. A more conservative approach to the question of introduction was willing to take up the challenge and work to restore the historical authenticity of those biblical writings which critical scholarship had dared to question. The culmination of these attempts is Theodor Zahn's introduction, 1838 through 1933 are the years of his life, and the first publication of this introduction was 1897 to 99. Theodore Sand's introduction wants to demonstrate that all writings of the New Testament, without exception, were written by genuine apostles. Sand's work has never been surpassed in its erudition, shrewdness, sophistry, and hair-splitting argumentation. And rarely has it been matched with respect to its assumption that all critical scholars must be malicious. It was Ferdinand Christian Bauer, the famous Tyrian theologian, who recognized that the real task was to reconstruct, on the basis of a critical evaluation of the sources, the primary issues of the historical process. Bauer tried to demonstrate that Christianity's problem is the search for the criteria which lie embedded in the process of history itself, and that critical self-assertion of Christian beliefs within the developments of history is a task rather than a fixed inherited endowment of the theological endeavor. Bauer also had no hesitation to include apocryphal and non-canonical materials in his investigation. He was indeed a church historian as much as a New Testament scholar. Finally, and this is of crucial importance, Bauer, and I quote here from an article of Heinz Liebing, which has been published in the Journal for Theology and the Church in Volume 3, 1967, Bauer does not permit any other question than that which is historically intended. Apart from history, theology would belong nowhere, unquote. Liebing concludes the article from which I quoted with a paragraph in which he remarks, quote, "What we have to learn from a new study of Bauer is more than method. If it were only a question of method, we would have to say that he actually rendered the reception of the historical critical method more difficult. Had theology learned from him earlier and better, then it would not have happened so easily that historical criticism was domesticated as a formal technique. It is understandable that theology was deeply shocked by Hegelianism, but innocence is no alternative to it," unquote. The tragedy of the subsequent development of the Tübingen school, which derived from Bauer's work and of scholarship thereafter, is that the comprehensive task which Ferdinand Christian Bauer had formulated became divided into several separate enterprises which all rested on Bauer's results rather than taking his methodological insights as a challenge. On the one hand, the discipline of New Testament introduction proper, and with it a large segment of the historical critical scholarship, slipped into a state of theological innocence after a successful defense of the authenticity of the canonical writings against the radical and extreme positions which some students of Bauer had taken. The serious historians of the Tübingen school, on the other hand, the most capable of these, I think, were Karl von Weizsäcker, since 1861, Ferdinand Christian Bauer's successor in Tübingen. The most serious of these were able to produce strictly historical descriptions of early Christianity, in which each writing is explained and the basis of its historical context. But non-canonical apocryphal writings were becoming marginal again. The hypothesis of Bauer about the basic antithesis of Jewish Christianity, the root Jerusalem apostles, and Gentile Christianity, Paul, had assumed the dimension of infallible dogma, and the historical questions had ceased to be critical theological questions at the same time. Not that nothing was done in the discipline of New Testament introduction ever since. On the contrary, but what was done was carried out as if nothing had happened. Adolf Jülich's introduction, representing the liberal wing, first published in 1894, was republished by Erich Fascher after the First World War, 1931, without any change in perspective. Paul Finer's introduction of 1913, pre-First World War, which was typical of a more conservative point of view, was revised by Johannes Behm and was re-edited in 1963 by Werner Georg Kümmel. This is now what we have, a Feiner Behm Kümmel. To be sure, was enlarged to encyclopedic dimension, but essentially without changing its basic orientation, and that after two world wars. Of course, New Testament critics have learned of more manuscripts, more, in fact, than are needed, Authors and editors of introductions have heard of form criticism, history of tradition, more recently even of a method called reduction criticism. Rarely enough, however, they seem to have taken notice of new source material. Yet what is most striking, the reconstruction of history, whether attempted or not, has not been recognized as a task that is not only a historical, but also a theological task. On the other hand, the theological emphasis and basic theological orientation of a large segment of New Testament students, especially represented by Rudolf Bultmann and his so-called school, has fallen short of the demand to unite the theological question with the historical task. Dialectic theology, as we know, was a courageous answer to the experience of the First World War, which had shaken the foundations of an optimistic cultural orientation of Christianity. It had become clear that history could no longer be seen as a long and continuous line of an evolution within which Christianity made its contribution by developing further and further into more lofty clarity the great religious and social ideas embedded in its own primitive beginning. On the contrary, since progressive developments had proven themselves to imply the possibility of eventual destruction and not only perfection, an insight which is very much with us today, one was tempted to turn to the great persons of history who had been able to stem the destructive tides of decline and fall again and again. One aspect of this trend at the period of dialectical theology was the renewal of Luther studies by such men as Karl Holl. Consequently, the most significant accomplishments of this new theology with respect to the historical writings of the New Testament came to lie in the reconstruction of the thought world of central figures, such as Jesus, John, and Paul, but often to the detriment of the reconstruction of the historical processes of which they were a part. This is very obvious, of course, in the New Testament theologians which we know and with which we work. Bultmann is one case in point. The more recent New Testament theology of Werner Georg Kümmel is just the same. It's a chapter on Jesus and a big chapter on Paul and a small chapter on John, and that's about it. Introduction was abused to provide objective scholarly judgments about the reliability of source materials on which one could base the presentations of the theology of such great personages. Whatever was deemed as a spurious writing or a tradition that was not originated by an apostle fell by the wayside. What could a letter that was not actually written by Paul contribute to the reconstruction of the deep thoughts of the great apostles' theology? Thus, New Testament introduction, having preserved its purity and austerity as a discipline among liberals and conservatives alike, in spite of its great erudition, has never managed to become an enterprise which is central for the vital interests of religious, theological, and historical understanding. At best, it has been useful as an ancillary discipline, helping to secure genuine source materials for scholars who wanted to base their discussions on reliable information, or aiding theologians who wanted to affirm the authenticity of canonical writings on which they based their doctrines and dogmas. Two, I would like to present to you some theses for the reformation of this discipline, which I would rename an introduction to early Christian literature. One, New Testament introduction as a theological discipline must produce criteria for an evaluation of new cultural developments and their fascinating suggestions of a departure to new shores. If it fails to do so, it has failed to understand the cultural and religious conflicts which have produced the literature of early Christianity, and it has misunderstood the purpose of the New Testament and of the New Testament canon. But what New Testament introduction wants to do is exactly to understand the purpose of such writing. Two, it is wrong to fix the beginning of the history of this discipline in the Enlightenment or pre-Enlightenment period. Even if we can reassure ourselves that the methods of inquiry of that period have some resemblance with our own concept of what is scholarly and scientific. Rather, The inquiry into the history of the discipline must begin with the earliest attempts to identify writings which could serve as critical canons in a situation of conflict. And that means for us, the history of the discipline begins with Marcion and Irenaeus in the 2nd century AD. The endeavors of these theologians were, by all means, critical and historical attempts. This is even more evident in the works of Origen and Eusebius, who continued the critical and theological investigation of those source materials which were intended to determine the church's future. Their primary question was by no means what was written by inspired apostles and what is therefore historically reliable. Rather, they asked which writings were used by the true believers from the beginning and have thus demonstrated their theological and religious power as sources that sustained the life of the churches. 3. Therefore, the beginning of the discipline belongs in the period in which the New Testament canon was created. The canon was not invented in order to assure the undisputed possession of a body of writings apart from our conflict. On the contrary, the canon was created as a critical weapon in a religious and cultural revolution. As such a weapon, it wanted to assure historical continuity and it wanted to prevent departures into spurious cultural religious objectives which were alien to the origins of the Christian faith and to the experience of the Christian churches. 4. The decision about canonicity cannot completely avoid uncertainty. It is probably wrong to assume that because of some uncertainties about specific writings, the limits of the canon were not yet firmly drawn in the 3rd and 4th century. They were drawn at that time. Almost all major New Testament writings were undisputed parts of the canon by the end of the 2nd century. Eusebius' church history exemplifies the real reasons for the uncertainties that still remained. Namely, the judgment depended upon one's own theological evaluation of the historical development. Such evaluation requires an assessment of all writings, canonical and non-canonical, from the early period of the church and of the historical circumstances which led to their production. This assessment, however, left uncertainties that occurred in the course of such reassessment. 5. Judgments about the exact time, place, and authorship of a particular writing are only preliminaries to the more important task, that is, to the reconstruction of history. History is not reconstructed by accumulating objective statements about facts. Rather, this requires an assessment of theological purpose and of intention of each and every document as part of an ongoing process. One could say this in terms of the traditional language of the church, that the Holy Spirit is a possession of the Christian communities and their lives through the history. One could say it with Ferdinand Christian Bauer, that it is tendenz kritik, as he said, which has to be done. It is here that theological questions can be formulated as historical questions. The historian who fails to do that does not only beg the vital theological concerns, he will also inevitably build up archives instead of writing history. 6. The question with which Richard Simon and in subsequent centuries the Enlightenment initiated the formal discipline of introduction were by no means unbiased and objective. They were typical and necessary questions of a conflict between Bible and religious tradition, or between Bible and the religious values of the Enlightenment period. Our own questions, we must learn, finally, are different. We are entitled to ask our own questions instead of repeating the questions of Richard Simon and his successors. We are entitled to ask these questions in our inquiry into ancient texts, and we have a right to expect that the texts will speak to us, will advise us, and will give their critical judgments to our thoughts. Otherwise, history will remain mute and speechless, and the historical inquiry an academic luxury. 7. The conflict of culture and religion is also documented in the sources with which we are dealing. What is required of us is the full investigation of all sources, Christian or pagan, orthodox or heretical, in their real historical perspective and constellation. History of religions is not a background, but is part of the movement of culture and religion to which early Christianity belonged. If we can assess the direction of a Christian quest for meaning, we may be able to discern theological issues in their historical context. There's no doubt that this makes the scholarly task more difficult and more demanding, but it also makes it much more worthwhile. I come to my last, third, and longest part, so don't hope that I'm through in a few minutes. Some perspectives and examples for a fresh approach. Let me first list some of the established canons of the discipline of New Testament introduction which must be abandoned in a fresh approach. So what I list now, I want to throw out of the window, and in fact I do it in my own writing of an introduction. One, the restriction to the 27 canonical writings of the New Testament is not possible. In order to recognize and to appreciate the character and the peculiar message of exactly these 27 writings, they must be treated in the context of the early Christian literature as a whole. Two, the treatment of writings in certain groups as suggested by traditional divisions of the canon, Gospels and Acts, Epistles, Revelations, is misleading. You know that that is the way in which all these New Testament introductions are divided into three parts. It can be justified only in the context of the study that is devoted to the more limited objective of a study of genres and types of literature. Three, the question of authenticity and authorship should be put into its proper perspective. That is, it is a tool to determine with some certainty fixed points in relation to each other along the lines of continuing development. But questions of authorship should never be construed in terms of value judgments, such as more or less genuine, spurious, authentic, inauthentic. I think these are Enlightenment categories. And as we are growing out of the Enlightenment age, we should finally decide to shed these eggshells of our great-grandfathers. Four, another type of value judgment must be thrown out. We are too much accustomed to consider as secondary and late whatever is more miraculous, less agreeable to our enlightened tastes, and less likely in terms of modern natural sciences. Another set of Enlightenment eggshells which we should get rid of. Five, the restriction of the consideration to literary critical questions, composition, sources, literary integrity, results in too narrow a perspective if the interest is ultimately to determine the situation of particular writings in the life of the church. The methods of form criticism and tradition criticism become more important than the traditional inquiries into composition, sources, authorship, and literary integrity. The results will be different from the mere attempt to make only a few modifications in our traditional procedures. New approaches must be tried out. In the following, I would like to suggest one possible procedure. I take my starting point from the observation that certain groupings of early Christian writings are suggested by their common use of the same apostolic authority, such as Paul, Peter, John, and others. Such groups of writings also seem to point to similar geographical origins, and often they are directly dependent upon each other, or they use the same kinds of traditional material. From this perspective, allow me to present a sample study in rough outline, in which I take as my specific chapter of a New Testament introduction, the Pauline literature. The first step would be an assessment of all available materials under the name of Paul or directly concerned with the work of this apostle. The following writings have been preserved. I'm trying to take this step by step now. One, more than a dozen letters. Two, a book entitled The Acts of Paul. Three, a book entitled The Acts of the Apostles by Luke, which in its second part is primarily dealing with Paul. Four, an apocalypse of Paul, as well as several other writings like The Acts of Paul and Andrew, The Passion of Peter and Paul, which the latter two I will not consider here because I don't want to complicate the question too much in this trial run. The first three letters, the Acts of Paul, and the Acts of the Apostles, seem to have a common geographical origin. They were apparently all written in Asia Minor or in Greece. For the letters, this is shown by internal evidence, even though one or the other letter may have been written in Rome. For the Acts of Paul, this is evidenced by a reference which Tertullian makes to this book. With respect to the Acts of the Apostles, I'm taking the common opinion of scholarship here as my working hypothesis. Let me first comment on the letters. Of the Pauline letters, a varying number occurs in the manuscript of the New Testament. The oldest papyrus that we have of the Pauline epistles, Papyrus 48, a Chester Beatty papyrus, contains fragments of 10 letters. Romans, 1st and 2nd Corinthians, Galatians, Ephesians, Colossians, Philemon, Philippians, 1st Thessalonians, and Hebrews. There's no trace of 2nd Thessalonians and of the so-called pastoral epistles 1 and 2 Timothy and Titus. On the other hand, the old Latin manuscripts, which go back to an equally early collection of the Pauline epistles, include the pastoral epistles plus a letter to the Laodiceans, that is, a total of 15 Pauline letters. But there are several letters. It is clear that the later manuscript tradition from the 4th century onwards contains 14 Pauline letters, which is the familiar number that has come into our canon. But there are several letters, in addition to the non-canonical letter to the Laodiceans, which have come down to us outside of writings which want to be writings of the Pauline epistles or writings of the New Testament. We have an additional letter to the Corinthians, known as 3rd Corinthians, which is included in the Acts of Paul, but is also transmitted independently, has been discovered in a Bodmer papyrus. And we have a correspondence between Paul and the Roman philosopher Seneca. Also, these have to be considered as part of the Pauline letters from the ancient church. Now, secondly, to the Acts of Paul, they're first attested by Tertullian, an external attestation which is no worse than that for many of the writings of the New Testament. The book never became a part of the New Testament canon, as we know, and has therefore come to us only in very fragmentary form. Just let me run through so that you have some idea what the difference is between a writing attested in the New Testament canon, of which we have sometimes thousands of manuscripts, and a writing which comes approximately from the same period and is not canonical. We have one Greek papyrus written about 300 AD, the Papyrus Hamburg, a Coptic papyrus from the 6th century, Heidelberg papyrus. We have several Greek manuscripts in Latin, and Latin, Syriac, Slavonic, and Arabic translations of a portion of this work, which is called the Acts of Paul and Thecla. We have Greek manuscripts and translation of the Martyrdom of Paul. In addition, a large number of small fragments with parts of the Greek of the text of this book exist. But we have no one single manuscript that gives us the whole work in one piece with certainty. Three, the Acts of the Apostles. The transmission of this book is very rich. However, it is preserved in two different versions. One represented by the Alexandrian texts of the New Testament, the other by the so-called Western text. The latter is usually longer, and by some scholars it has been considered to be the original edition of the book by the author, though critical editions of the New Testament usually print the other, the Alexandrian text. Text critical scholarship has not been able, until today, to give certain evidence for either one of these two versions as the more original one. Honestly, one has to say we don't know. We have two different versions, either one of which may be the older or the original. With respect to the relationship of the various documents to each other, the internal evidence is confusing. Some of the letters seem to be dependent upon others, and so on. This can be documented in detail. But the relationship among these letters is not something that can be considered without reference to the other Pauline writings. Also, these contain a number of interesting relationships. The Acts of Paul not only seems to use some of the Pauline letters, it also includes one of these letters, 3 Corinthians, as part of the narrative. This book also uses information about Paul's travel plans that at the same time was available to the author of the pastoral epistles and seems to be pretty interesting. On the other hand, Luke's Acts of the Apostles seems to be completely oblivious of the fact that Paul ever wrote any letters. The book never mentions any such letters, and whether Luke was Paul's travel companion or whether he was some later author of the second generation of Christianity, this remains strange indeed, because we have certain clues which indicate that collections of some of Paul's epistles were made very soon after his death. Must further consider what normally is called the external evidence for the existence of any of these writings. The term, I think, is misleading. insofar as usage of any of these writings by some other author is not simply an external attestation to enable us to make conclusions about the time at which certain writings were already in existence. Sounds sometimes, when scholars refer to the external evidence, that first the author of First Clement or Ignatius of Antioch had used the Pauline epistles for no other reason than a modern critical scholar was able to say that the Pauline epistles must have existed at that time. External evidence also constitutes part of the living extension of Paul's activity and witnesses to the continuing life of his work and to the various controversial issues which it had raised. The first external evidence is found in the first epistle of Clement, which dates from the last decade of the first century and refers to Paul's epistles frequently. Even more abundant is the usage of such epistles in the letters of Ignatius of Antioch, which were written about 110 AD. Remarkably, both the second epistle to the Corinthians and the pastoral epistles are never referred to in either First Clement or in Ignatius. But that does not necessarily mean that these Pauline letters were not yet written at that time, nor can one conclude that all those Pauline epistles which are quoted here must therefore be genuine. The use of Paul's epistles in Ignatius demonstrates the lively continuation of the discussion of some of the central themes of Paul's theology, although the theme of justification by faith, dear to our heart as Lutherans, is completely missing. The term righteousness only appears once in Ignatius, and that not in a quotation from Paul, but in a quotation from Matthew, or a tradition that was also came into the Gospel of Matthew. The most faithful disciple of Paul of that period, thus, had no access to justification and righteousness by faith. On the other hand, one Clement is primarily interested in Paul as a teacher of morality and proper conduct in the church. One Clement gives evidence for the knowledge of Pauline letters in Rome by the turn of the first century. But the apologist Justin Martyr, half a century later, never quotes anything from Paul, although he taught in Rome, as did at the same time the ship owner Marcion from Sinope in Pontus, who edited the first canonical collection of Pauline epistles, albeit without the pastorals. An introduction to these Pauline writings must discuss and analyze the historical developments and theological issues which have contributed to the various noteworthy phenomena which we have enumerated briefly above. The necessary historical theological quest also implies that one cannot, in the frequently observed fashion of New Testament introductions, leave the decisive introductory questions open and dangling, as, for example, such and such letter may or may not have been written by Paul, but we will proceed to harvest our theological fruits from the document anyway. One must insist that a writing and its content cannot be fully understood unless one is willing to assign, albeit hypothetically, a place to such a writing in the historical and theological developments of early Christianity. A good starting point, it seems to me, methodologically, is the consideration of the form and function of a particular document or a group of writings. Several letters which have come to us under the name of Paul reveal that they are meant to be instruments of church organization. They reflect directly the problems which must have arisen in the building up of only recently founded religious communities, and they are either substitutes for personal visits, or they are media which serve better than a personal visit and oral communication would do at a particular political moment. For example, the letter which is preserved in 2 Corinthians 10 through 13 was written by Paul because a personal confrontation at that critical moment of the controversy apparently would have been counterproductive. We are well advised to assign such letters to Paul himself as long as we cannot detect any traces of imitation and pseudonymity in them. 1 Thessalonians, Galatians, Philippians, 1 Corinthians, and the letters now compiled as 2 Corinthians obviously belong in this category. The interpretation of such letters must proceed together with the reconstruction of the history of the Pauline mission and of the controversies which arose in this process. Other documents have a distinctly different character. The Epistle to the Romans is a letter of introduction and an apologetic summary of Paul's theology. Don't be afraid, I don't think that it is not genuine, it's genuine too. The summary of Paul's theology is also the letter to the Ephesians, although it lacks the element of the letter of the recommendation which is so conspicuous in Romans. Both writings look back upon the other letters of Paul, or upon their theological content, as something that is already in the past. This is a perspective which they share with the use that Ignatius of Antioch makes of the Pauline epistles. Ignatius, however, shows yet another kind of dependence upon the Pauline letters. He uses the form of the Pauline letter as an instrument of church organization and of polemical controversy. But there is a conspicuous difference between Paul and Ignatius in this respect. Ignatius tries to influence already established Christian communities, and he attacks formulated heresies with respect to their false teachings, whereas Paul himself confronted critically theological problems which had arisen within the process of the establishment of such communities themselves. That Ignatius is writing a letter of recommendation for himself, also to the Romans, shows that Paul's letter to the Romans had become a traditional norm. In Colossians and 2 Thessalonians, we find that the genre of the Pauline letter has become an instrument of polemics against religious aberration, which threaten the integrity of the accepted Pauline teachings. Of a different kind are those letters which turn the Pauline attempt to organize the life of his churches through written communications into the propagation of church order. The tendency is clearly visible in the use that one Clement makes of the Pauline writing. It is well established in the pastoral epistles, which are in fact church orders in the form of pseudepigraphical letters. This indicates a development in which the form of the Pauline letter, once it was established in the churches, which emerged from the Pauline mission, could be reused in order to communicate true doctrine and true order for the church. Also, the letter to the Laodiceans and the third letter to the Corinthians belong in this category. There are a number of interesting parallels from the pagan world, and if there were more time, I would elaborate this more in detail. Philosophical schools at that time used the writing of fictitious letters under the name of famous persons as a literary framework for the promulgation of philosophical doctrine, inasmuch as also famous philosophers of that period had actually written letters to friends or to relatives, compare Cicero's and Seneca's correspondence, in order to propagate their philosophical views. This assumed life situation produced the correspondence between Paul and Seneca. A parallel for other Pauline letters are the letters, for example, of the emperors, through which they tried to instruct the officials in various provinces and cities with respect to specific important questions. The Pauline pastoral epistles, Paul writing to Timothy and Titus, directing them with respect to the life of the communities in Ephesus and in Crete, reflect this genre. This can be elaborated further. It is obvious that in several categories of Pauline letter production, materials from the mission of Paul and from the letters he wrote have been used and reused. Use of Pauline traditions also has been made by those writings which belong to a different literary genre, that is, the Acts of Luke and the Acts of Paul. However, the material that is used here is of a different character. Paul was remembered here as a great and successful missionary, and that meant performance of miracles, documentation of the possession of divine spirit through powerful speeches, public and through deep scriptural exegesis. The literature which presents this image is almost entirely propaganda literature, and in this respect follows pagan examples of a similar literary production, which are more typically religious than the genre of the letter, which is either political or philosophical in character, which Paul used himself. The existence of such books of the Pauline Acts gives evidence for the continuation of the peculiar Pauline pattern, that is, the demonstration of the gospel as religious power as a primary means of the further expansion of Christianity in the pagan world. The second step, which I would take methodologically and which I will cut short here, is that which I would more properly call form criticism, and it has to be accompanied by the question of style and vocabulary. Form criticism would primarily have to deal with the history, establish a parallel history of the traditions in the church as they have been used and developed. Liturgical materials, creeds, hymns, orally transmitted narratives, miracle stories, novels, anecdotes. These can be brought in a chronological sequence and in a subject matter sequence as they were carried on in the life of the church over at least a century, if not more. An investigation of vocabulary and style would provide criteria for the relative dating of some of these writings. The Deutero-Pauline writings can be recognized, for example, insofar as they reveal a style of Pauline argumentation which has become stereotyped. Vocabulary is very sensitive with respect to certain fashions and also in view of an opponent's abuse. Once certain terms become key terms of the opponent's vocabulary, they only occur with certain qualifying attributes. For example, the term gnosis, knowledge, is frequently used by Paul, but in the pastoral epistles it occurs only once, and here with the modifier falsely so-called gnosis. Also with respect to form and style, the horizon must be expanded to include Jewish and pagan literature of that period. Again, one can quote the pastoral epistles, 1 Clement, the epistles of Ignatius, as examples which reflect more than any other writings in the Pauline tradition the typical linguistic elements which are characteristic of the Greek of the literature of the 2nd century AD rather than the 1st. Only after completion of such considerations and analyses will it be possible to reconstruct that section of early Christian history which has produced the literature of the Pauline corpus at large. Historical and literary developments will have to be accounted for, as well as the theological issues and controversies. The question of authorship in such reconstruction, I trust, will lose much of its value and of its mystique. Instead, the precise determination of the place of both the extant literature and of the development of traditions will have to be the main focus. Once the scholar has done his homework in the critical analysis of sources, the introduction might be able to present the topics of its subject matter in a way like the following. And I want to outline at the conclusion just a few steps in which I think I'm just writing my introduction myself, and which I think would be more worthwhile and a more responsible historical and theological approach. First chapter would be the calling and the early mission of Paul, of which we can gain some fragmentary knowledge on the basis of his letters and of some older traditions in the book of Acts. In this context belong typical features of the beliefs, the worship, and the diversified religious convictions in the all early Pauline churches, as they are visible in traditions which are quoted in Paul's letters. 2, the period of Paul's ministry, which is directly related to the extant letters that he wrote. This will include a description of the effort of the organization of churches and the controversies with opposing interpretations of the Christian tradition. The role and function of the letters in their original form as part of these activities, and a theological evaluation of the work accomplished by Paul in this brief period, its problems, and its interesting but also ambiguous religious potential. 3rd chapter, early post-Pauline Christianity. The development of tendencies which Paul had opposed would have to be discussed here. For example, the use of the Pauline authority and of Pauline letters in the service of a Gnosticizing Christianity, and the renewal of the expectation of an impending parousia in the name of Paul. The letters to the Ephesians and Colossians and 2 Thessalonians seem to answer such problems under the authority of the great apostle. At the same time, a tradition must have developed that transmitted stories of Paul as the great traveling miracle worker, and this tradition was spread in the interests of a continuing Christian propaganda. 4th chapter, first attempts to consolidate the Pauline tradition. The first collection of the Pauline epistles was made that contained all letters which are now part of the New Testament canon, except 2 Corinthians and the pastoral epistle, and of course Hebrews, which I think has to bracket it in the context of Pauline letters. Perhaps also except 2 Thessalonians, that's not quite clear. Ignatius of Antioch and Clement of Rome attest the wide circulation of this collection, and the theological perspectives which these letters present also became influential in the formation of the first written gospel, Mark, which is distinctly Pauline in its sense of mystery and its theology of the cross. 5th chapter, the author of Luke Acts is an important representative of the next phase. Against the paradoxical and enigmatic theology of the letters in which Paul appears as the representative of Christ's death in this world, Ignatius of Antioch understood this just as well as the author of the Gospel of Mark. The author of Luke Acts now erects on the basis of the tradition of Paul's the tradition of the miracle stories of Paul, a monument that pictures Paul as the successful missionary of the church who carries, guided by the Spirit, the gospel from Jerusalem to Rome. One may also note that Luke re-edits the Pauline Gospel of Mark in an analogous fashion. On the other hand, an unknown editor in Corinth at the same time seems to have composed several fragments of unedited, genuine Pauline writings into an impressive document which is known as the Second Epistle to the Corinthians. This collection reinforces against Luke the tradition that saw Paul as a messenger who represents in his life the secret and paradoxically human presence of the divine rather than the public demonstration of a religious power. The line 6, the line represented by Luke must have lived on strongly, nevertheless. It makes its reappearance in the Acts of Paul, which does not use Luke Acts, but depends upon a rich, independent tradition. Here, even the death of Paul became a demonstration of divine power, whereas Luke had not yet dared to include the work, to conclude his work, with an account of Paul's martyrdom, for whatever reasons. But although this work, the Acts of Paul, combines the miracle worker tradition with the image of the dying apostle, the existing corpus of Paul's letters itself still called for a solution, since by now it apparently had become one of the most important books, also of the Gnostic and not only of the Christian movement. The Acts of Paul had tried to solve this problem by inserting an anti-Gnostic letter of Paul into the corpus, 3 Corinthians. The attempt that was made in the invented correspondence between Paul and Seneca to present Paul as a true philosopher was obviously no answer, though it shared the world-open attitude of the second century apologists. Even less satisfactory must have been the letter to the Laodiceans, a patchwork of those quotations from Paul's epistles which were acceptable to some circles of the church. 7th chapter. Two successful solutions emerged, which brought the epistles of Paul into a perspective in which they became documents that gave direction to the continuing life of religious communities. One by Marcion, the other by the author of the pastoral epistles. Marcion's revised edition of the Pauline epistles, which tried to reconstruct the original form of these letters, makes Paul once again an apostle who proclaims a new message of salvation. In the pastoral epistles, on the other hand, Paul is foremost a church leader, a teacher, and organizer. Some such traditions about his activities were apparently still available to the author, apart from the earlier letters. Within this horizon, the transmitted collection of his epistles was allowed to survive in spite of inconsistencies and ambiguities in theological orientation, which is represented in the collection itself. As we all know, it was this latter solution which the church later canonized. This was not done because one believed in Paul as the great religious individual through which the Holy Spirit spoke with divine authority. Rather, this canonization came out of the confidence that the Holy Spirit is a gift that was given to the church. The successors of those Christian communities in Asia Minor and Greece, which Paul himself had founded and organized, canonized this particular collection of epistles together with the book of Acts, because these writings had proven to be forces which had sustained and nourished the life of believers in these churches for several generations. And it was a collection of writings that promised to do so for many more generations to come down to our own time. It is very much necessary for theology and church today to learn from the dynamics of such developments as they become visible through historical inquiry that at the same time takes up theological questions. Thank you very much.
Professor Kester has consented to answer some questions, so fire away.
Assuming for the moment that I'd like to assume it, that your approach to New Testament introduction will win its way, would you comment more than you did earlier about the kinds of impacts you might think it might have on, let's say, our theological understanding of the New Testament.
I'm always tempted in a lecture like this to expand it to about twice its size in order to say more about this, and I have to restrain myself in my answer. But let me try to say this. This is very much a question that is close to my heart. I would hope that it would help us to understand Christian responsibility, Christian church responsibility today, as a truly historical task in our own age, rather than as a process of a static platform that can be compared to the static platform of canon back there. But discover, as we discover the dynamics in the history that created the New Testament writings, to discover also the dynamics and the challenge of the history of Christian churches in our own age. This is my personal hermeneutical conviction that it is in this realm. And that would involve not just seeing theological issues in a dynamic perspective rather than a static affirmation, but it would also involve to see the interplay between general cultural and theological questions, the interplay between political developments and Christian decisions towards such political developments. And I find exactly here once one has discovered that perspective, as many of us know who have had some experience in teaching New Testament, what can be learned from the documents of the New Testament, not just from the great theology of Paul, but from the struggle of the individual writer of many, many writings, from the development of the tradition. It is a fantastic and rewarding learning experience that is that never becomes boring. And therefore I made this one remark. I think we have to bring our own questions of our own religious, cultural, political experience into such an inquiry, rather than accepting, and here I'm almost cynical, rather than accepting these absolutely irrelevant questions. For us, absolutely irrelevant. They may have been important for the 17th and 18th century questions that formed the discipline of introduction, which were informed by a non-historical type of, and non-theological type of asking who wrote which writing when.
I'd like to ask you a question, if I may.
Sure may, Everett.
The way that you presented this with 2 Corinthians put in juxtaposition to Luke, Acts, the kind of things Kazeman talked about in regard to does the New Testament establish the unity of the church, and pointing to all kinds of currents within the New Testament, and now you're saying we've got to look beyond these pages to see continuations of these currents. People saying something we could call realized eschatology, other people saying it's a heresy to say the resurrection has already occurred, and so forth. You saying that the Holy Spirit is continuing in the life of the Christian community makes one ask if there is a place, and what the place is, of a word like authentic and inauthentic, in regard to the ways in which, here I don't mean anything about authorship, I mean authentic and inauthentic in ways in which the Pauline message or the gospel of salvation is presented. How does one tell ways that one can say, here the Holy Spirit is not guiding the church, here he is, in regard to some of the movements in the life of the church even to this day?
I should have asked for half an hour before I had my simple answer in one sentence is that yes, there is such a place. But not, let me say it negatively first.
I think not insofar as we can put ourselves up as judges of history. I think here humility is a better virtue of the historian and theologian. Also not in such a way that one could put up one particular writing or groups of writing, the famous thing of the canon within the canon, over against another group of writings that are just aren't so good. A very well-known practice, not only since Luther, but also before him and after him. So that then the Epistle of James appears as the Strohne Epistle once you have decided that Paul is the true gospel. I would rather think that, now let me ask a third now, not also in terms of success, which is very tempting to say those who have won out, they are the good God, and those who have lost must have not enough power of the Holy Spirit, otherwise this wouldn't have happened to them. There's an interesting parallel to this which I remember very well. When I was the last years of the war in the German army, trying to fight some of you or your fathers, there was the saying that Gott ist immer mit den stärkeren Bataillonen. God is always with those who are the stronger ones, and therefore since we were the stronger ones, or God was with us, I wasn't ever so clear what was first. There was no question about the fact that Germany would win the war. Not in that sense either, but the search that I would make for criteria for authentic and inauthentic, I think I'd go back to something I've tried to say in the article you quoted of One Jesus and Four Primitive Gospels, namely that there is such a thing as an authentic Christian relationship to not only the message of Jesus, but also to that which Jesus' suffering and death stands for. And that is a question around which one cannot go. It cannot be avoided. I think that someone who wants to avoid that question of authenticity, which is the question ultimately of faith, of obedience, of love, with respect to that message of Jesus and that message about Jesus, a historical theology that wants to avoid this, I think misses the point. Because that is the one relationship to the one historical continuum to the incarnation and thus the continuation of the incarnation itself. One can speak about the problems that are connected as we observe the history of ancient Christianity in such attempt of Christians, genuine Christians, to remain faithful to that ongoing living presence of Jesus and his word. It seems to me, however, and here I'm very partial, and my colleagues in the history department at Harvard have been shocked occasionally, though otherwise they think I'm a pretty good scholar and therefore they still talk to me. Here I would say that it is something that cannot be decided outside of the very same questions which not I as an individual, but I as a member of the church today in my century have to answer to. This question has not become outdated yet for me, and because it hasn't become outdated, but seems to me the basic and decisive question of my own life and the life of my Christian brothers and sisters with whom I know I am connected in the church, because that is so, the discourse along the lines of that question of the faith and obedience to that faith which was witnessed in the New Testament, in the early Christian writings, which relates to what Jesus has said and what Jesus suffered, that circle is sort of at the heart of the hermeneutical circle. The trouble with that thing is that it isn't a question that one can decide theoretically. It isn't a question that one can decide in any kind of formulation of theological thought. It seems to me, and that is serious, it seems to me that it can only be decided in the effort of Christian life, for which the ultimate criterion remains love. If
such authors as the Gospel of John have still anything to say to us. And in that particular challenge of a Christian existence, it seems to me to rest ultimately the whole enterprise also of the theological interpretation of early Christian history, and has to, there the chips are down, finally, if anywhere. And I'm sorry that that is so. I think it can be great, it can be terrible and destructive, but I think it is so because God is love. And because that story here is the story of the revelation of God's love and nothing else.
Robert? Dr. Tesser, you gave us as a sample the way in which you would treat the Pauline literature. Could you just sketch how the rest of the book works out? You do the Jesus tradition and the Johannine literature and perhaps something else. And then I guess the second question, kind of related to what Ev asked before, and that would be, for example, you said number 5 in your chapters in the Pauline tradition would deal with Luke Acts. You deal with that twice, once with the Jesus tradition and once again in terms of Paul.
Yes.
And then a third question would be, again, like Ev's question, when you deal with it in the sequence of chapters under Pauline tradition, do you really treat it as a kind of a degenerate Paulinism? I take it that that was part of what Ev was asking, that actually within the canon, within the writings which deal with the death and resurrection as central in God's moving towards us, Luke doesn't still represent the death of Jesus the way the Paul of the letters does, or the way even Ignatius of Antioch does.
I would definitely not like to use the word degenerate because I think it's unjust. It's a little difficult to outline all the chapters. I think with good justification I can bind the presentation to certain originally geographically localized indigenous development. And I have a chapter on Syria and one on Egypt and one on Eastern Syria, and my last chapter is on Rome and on the development of Christianity in North Africa in Carthage, and so that which seems to me the nucleus of many important developments in the West, and I try to treat the literature in this context. But as you have observed here, it is impossible to avoid bringing the same writings in several times. But I think that is necessary because we know that these writings have continued to live. They didn't fall dead somewhere in some seminary library after they were written and sat there. But they continued to live. They were sent around, and Polycarp collected Ignatius' epistles and apparently sent them out on request to other churches. We have evidence in this in Polycarp's letter to the Philippians, etc., etc. So one can see movements that go in various directions and form particular shapes, new shapes, in various geographical areas. It is, I admit, it is a job that is it's a little bit complicated at points, and I've been frustrated. I'm sort of feeling I would have liked to write the book sort of three-dimensional, you know, not only on the paper, but there must be a third dimension to which one can draw the line. But since books aren't three-dimensional, I can't do it. I have to see to get it in the two dimensions. But that, I understand, is the frustration of anyone who wants to interpret history and writings. You can't get around it. I think it is still more worthwhile than to say, let's have it very simple, Gospels A, Matthew B, Mark C, Luke, and go through the writings in this way. Let me say one thing more to the question of degenerate. I think that I have very much stopped or ceased to use such terms. Because if Paul used miracles,
as part of his missionary activity to demonstrate the power of the gospel. We know this. He says so himself. Of course, we knew that he ran into trouble, 2 Corinthians, with people who abused miracles, and Paul is very critical of that. But if Paul used miracles to demonstrate the power of the gospel, what right do we have to call the Acts of the Apostles degenerate if they renew that tradition of the powerful apostle who used miracles and the propagation of the gospel, to call him degenerate? We may not like it. We may see certain points in Paul's theology that should really have prevented this kind of development. But first one should see its role and function in the actual development of the expansion of Christianity. And I would also not call necessarily the Acts of Paul degenerate. They're dealing with a number of very interesting questions. For example, no one wants to talk about it for decades. Now the women come and say, well, the women in history, here the Acts of Paul and Thecla. And they may have contain a lot of very miraculous stories. Some of these seem hilarious to us. But they still deal with a very important issue with which perhaps some circles of early Christianity have not been able to come to a satisfactory solution, namely of the role of women as missionaries and miracle workers. This is the acts of Paul devote a considerable amount of their space to exactly that question, and to the relationship of such women as miracle workers and missionaries to men in the same business as, for example, Paul. It becomes clear at the same time that many of these developments, a larger emphasis on miracles or less emphasis on miracles, more emphasis on a philosophical defense of Christianity, as in the letters of Paul to Seneca and in the apologists of the second century, very much dependent upon cultural modes, trends, which come and go. As we see in our own time, all sorts of things come and go, and many unexpectedly. And value judgments, one perhaps should always try out first value judgments as within the context of the investigation of history itself. I do have very explicit value judgments. I think that there are a number of writings, and I said this at the end of my paper, who have played a very specific role as the sustaining tradition of the church, which other writings have not. This is not a division between orthodox and not orthodox, not necessarily perhaps even canonical and non-canonical. It includes a number of writings which are perfectly orthodox, which later, First Clement, for example, is an early writing, earlier than some canonical writings, which the fathers of the church who created the canon did not include because they were not witnessed to as having the same religious sustaining power in the use of Christian churches as the others. And that is perhaps the judgment that is the most legitimate value judgment, if you want to make any value judgment at all.
It seems to me that perhaps then what we need is that, or at least this approach would really open us up to being able to proclaim the gospel better in a multicultural world like we have today, if we understand that what seemed to us in past generations with our hang-up about justification as the form of which the gospel should be proclaimed for eternity, this somehow opens us up to seeing this seemingly lesser expression where it's say in the act that the gospel is seen more in terms of just the resurrection and sort of thing. And if we see these documents and expressions of the gospel against their different cultural setting, because they're speaking to a different cultural problem, therefore we're able to come out with different formulations of the gospel for different cultural situations today. And so what we need perhaps is an expansion of the view of the gospel rather than a reduction of one.
Well, I'm not sure whether I'm agreeing with the last comment.
Yeah.
Because it could very well be a reduction that would be the appropriate answer. A reduction to some essentials that could be the appropriate answer in a particular situation. I think you're right, of course. The trouble is that it makes it more difficult and not easier. It also makes it more difficult to recognize who our brothers and sisters are and who the demons are. That is simple if there is only one Christian option. But there are 56, and you know that probably only 21 are legitimate. That makes life with other Christians more difficult. Though it is a situation which we have anyway today, so we might as well face it. If one says, no, we have only one single option, this is simply saying something which isn't true. There are more than 56 different Christian options. And we know that many of them are very closely related to very specific and individual cultural developments. So we might as well recognize this, which means we'll load quite a burden of troubles on our shoulders. But I think we'll be more truthful to the situation, the religious situation of our century, into which God has sent us. They seem to be here, and I agree with you. But we shouldn't kid ourselves and say that was great. It's great, but it's very difficult.
Drawing on to 9:30, perhaps if there's one more question that someone would like to ask, and there are some refreshments over there, maybe you can ask another question or two in the context of the refreshments. Is there one more?
Oh, I'd ask a question. Is it possible, about kissing and that, dealing with the present gospel that we have today, would it be possible we could take the present gospel and deal from its approach today, from where it stands, instead of wanting to the reproduction of pre-literature to find the real, I would say, germ, and express it more so relating to person to person? And would this be a way of responding to the gospel in its true meaning, or to see the gospel as a part of dealing with man to man instead of the culture at that time? Or would it be helpful to know this culture? Would it be any good for the present time? Or should we take it from its standpoint of where it is and compare it in our lives and use it as a token from there?
Yeah. I see two things involved in your question. One is, if I understand you right, whether today it is necessary to go into the whole problematic of our present culture. And my answer to this is we better. There is a suggestion of a simple Jesus religion that seems to give us an alternative that doesn't make it so terribly complicated to be a Christian in this world. But I just happen to be an incurable Lutheran, and in spite of everything I've said, I'm coming back to Paul, and I think Paul has seen deeper. Paul has seen that Christians just cannot avoid the engagement in the world of cultural conflict in which they live. It's something that will come if we withdraw in a corner and say, no, we just want our fellow brothers and sisters. It will come, and it's better to face it. The other thing is, I think it's very good to start from there and say, this is the gospel as I understand it, and this is what I think, this is the way I have to go. I don't think you have to go back to Paul or to early Christian history to learn what the gospel is. But I think we better stop once in a while and look for criteria that help us to find our way right. And the question of this whole enterprise of New Testament interpretation and history and theology is, I think, the question of is the question from whom do we want to learn? If we are not just convinced we can pull ourselves out of the mess in which we all are,
out of the swamp in which we all are just pulling on our own hair, but want to have an ability to look beyond into the experiences of other Christian communities, of other Christian peoples at another time, and none as impressive, I think, in the whole history of Christianity as the experience of the early Christians. To learn from that history is an extremely worthwhile and valuable experience that may very well give us perspectives on our ongoing path that could prove to be very helpful, and without which we may very well go in the wrong direction and end up God knows where before we even notice it.
Well, at the end, first of all, a brief reminder, tomorrow morning, 9:15 at University of Missouri, St. Louis, Corby Finney, who's sitting over in the corner there, will be glad to provide directions if anyone is interested in going and isn't quite sure how to get there. Corby, just hold up your hand. He'll be your guide to UMSL. There is coffee and cookies over there for everyone. And Dr. Kester, we're very indebted to you. Thank you very much.